So let's go for the challenge that we had last week. We didn't have an official challenge. There was nothing for you to pick up and grab. On the contrary, it was more just like I gave you something to consider, something to think about before we met again here this evening. And that was really just to spend time reflecting on what challenge has challenged you the most over the past year. And we've been doing these for about a year now, so I was curious what has... interpret that word challenged any way you want. It's what the heart of the question is: how has it benefited you? What have you found difficult but still edifying? Something along those lines, and that's really what I want to hear, because it's really feedback from you all that helps us get better challenges in the future. So, what has challenged you the most this past year in terms of the challenges that I put out in the foyer?
One challenge, I'm not sure if it's inviting it to something. It seems to work for me. So, as a pastor, it's very easy to relax. You know, it's like a big job.
Yeah.
If you want to put stuff on you, or negative, you want to regulate, you want to put stuff on you. Pastor, you're getting very uncertainty, you know, take a deep breath.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And I mean, that frustration is not unique to you. That's the human experience. I think I've fallen into so many times just letting one misplaced item or something I've missed or forgot to mark down in my calendar just really take over my day. And by the time that happens, my mind's not focused on God. It's not focused on the beauty of creation or studying the Word or being in constant dialogue with God in prayer. It's like I'm focused on that thing that I messed up. I'm focused on that thing that I missed. So that's a challenge, and it is for all of us because it's something that we all deal with in one way or another. Absolutely. Anybody else reminiscing a little bit or looking back on a challenge that has challenged you this year? Something that has edified you, something that is, they've been so easy, is what I'm hearing. They've all these challenges, you've breezed through them, no problem. If you can't think of it now, and we have extra time, I can bring this up again at the end, give you a little bit more time to think it through. That's what we can do moving forward. In the meantime, though, we can just go ahead and jump back into Acts. And we're in Acts chapter 24. We're just beginning chapter 24. We just wrapped up 23. And we get a pretty exciting bit going on here where Paul is kind of under siege from these assassins in Jerusalem. They're threatening his life. His nephew is going to the commander saying, hey, here's the plot. Here's what is afoot. We need to get Paul out of here. And what Lysias the commander does, he writes a letter to the governor, a man by the name of Felix, that really discusses the problem at hand, what's essentially going on. He writes it in a way that he kind of absolves himself of any crime. Remember, we talked about that he was about to scourge Paul. He had already bound him to things that were against the law to be done to a Roman citizen, which Paul was. And Paul spoke up saying, hey, would you do this to a Roman? And suddenly the Roman commander, the Roman garrison said, uh-oh, we might have made a mistake. He leaves that part out in his letter to the governor. He leaves that out. But instead essentially tells him, this is the man I'm sending to you. Here is why I am sending him to you. And essentially, we want his accusers to come to you so you can kind of act as jury. And what they did from then on was really essentially built up a police escort for Paul. I think it was about 470 people, some on horseback, some not. Take him about 25 miles away before half of them depart. And they really guide him through the city, making sure that he's not assaulted, making sure he's not accosted, most importantly, that he's not assassinated. But he arrives in Herod's praetorium, and where we left off was essentially Felix waiting for his accusers to come forth, to come and present a charge against him. And that's what we get here in Acts chapter 24. So if you've got your scriptures out, you can go ahead and turn there with me. And we're just going to pick up in verse 1. It says, "Now, after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul." So this is the setup of the passage. This is everything that's going to be happening, at least today, with what we're talking about, is all going to be kind of in a little bit of a court drama is what's happening, being set out here. We're getting the recap of what happened in this court dialogue in the presence of Felix. "And in the presence of all three, Ananias, the elders, and it says a skilled orator, Tertullus," which a skilled orator essentially means he was a lawyer. That is his role here. They would have hired him and brought him to this place to be the prosecution. But this setup kind of really reminds us about how serious the Jewish leadership is about obtaining a conviction for Paul. They'd already failed to do so back at the temple. They already failed to kill Paul multiple times, whether it was scheduled to happen with the assassins who vowed not to eat until Paul was dead, or in another instance where three separate instances where violence start to break out in the presence of Paul, and the Roman commander Lysias had removed Paul from the situation, really fearing for his life. They failed in those instances, so they're like, okay, here's the next best thing. We need to obtain a conviction against him. What is the harshest sentence we can find for this man? And again, they're in the presence of the governor, Felix, and I think we need a moment to talk about who Felix was, because it's kind of important to understand his background. His name was Antonius Felix, and he began life as a slave. He had a brother, though, named Pallas, who was a friend of the Emperor Claudius, and that really helped him advance through life. First as a child, he gained his freedom. Then later on in life, he became the first former slave to become the governor of a Roman province. And for us, we might be thinking, oh, a life such as this would lead him to really deal with the people that found themselves at his feet with mercy and grace, and really couldn't be farther from the truth. Unfortunately, that was not the case. Tacitus, a Roman historian, he described Felix, and I'm quoting here, "a master of cruelty and lust who exercised the powers of a king with the spirit of a slave." He also wrote, "Felix thought he could do any evil act with impunity." He's not a good person. He takes his power, and he really rules with an iron fist. He thinks he can do anything with the position that he has, thinks he can do anything to anyone. So this is really a dangerous character that Paul has found himself in the face of. That's kind of something that we have to keep in mind as we're going through what these individuals are saying to him. And we can kind of pick up in verse 2 where Tertullus begins talking. And as he does so, I want to ask something of you all. I want you to really place yourself in the shoes of Felix, not as the cruel governor, but rather as the jury. Place yourselves in the shoes of a jury for this trial. I want you to listen to it as a jury would the prosecution, the defense, and whatnot, and because after he's done speaking, I want to ask you what you heard. If you're trying to decide a verdict of innocent or guilty, what are you hearing when Tertullus speaks? So, go ahead in verse 2. "And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, 'Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear, by your courtesy, a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law, but the commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. So these are his opening statements. This is what he has to say. These are his accusations against Paul. And I just broadly want to poll you all, what are you hearing here? What are you hearing him say? Anything interesting, anything you can pick out, or just the broad ideas? Yeah. Yeah, a lot of flattery right out of the gate. I think it's about half of what he has to say is just really worshiping Felix, just trying to pat his ego as much as possible. Yeah. Right. Kind of vague, more or less. Yeah, I think that's another really good insight. Anything else? What are we noticing? We got two really, really good things so far. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think that's what they're really trying to create more of a, without any specific charges, trying to make themselves appear the victim. That all these, they're just a victim of the circumstances of Lysias really extending past his purview and Paul just generally being a nuisance. Yeah. Anything else that we noticed in here? Anything else pique your interest? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he tried to profane the temple. And I think you'll really key in on that being a false charge because they don't say how. He here's the vaguest thing we could possibly say without any evidence, without any eyewitness testimony. He profaned the temple. What does that mean? That doesn't help any. I think their hope is that Felix, without any real understanding of the Jewish culture and religion, will just kind of nod along. Yes, of course, he profaned the temple. But there is not really a charge here so much as it is just a vague accusation with no basis. Anybody else? Yeah. Yes. With great violence. Yeah, he throws him right under the bus. And I think we talked about, like, it does start off with that he does kind of, Lysias extends his role. Like, he's about to scourge Paul. He binds him, not knowing he's a Roman citizen. But after that happens, he's really trying to do his job. He personally saves Paul's life several times, pulling him out of the fray. And to the Jews, they're like, we were just about to kill that guy. What do you do? So I think he kind of made an enemy of them, even though he'd been saving Paul's life up until that point. Yeah, that's a good insight. It's a good insight. Anything else?
This man, so I have blind, but even licensed, for reacting, as a solid,
generally. Yeah. 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 That's pretty spot on. What else do we got? Anything else from these eight or so verses? All right. I think we're pretty much we got most of it. I'm pretty impressed. I think y'all picked up on a lot of what's going on here. But we talked about the trial begins. Tertullus, he showers Felix with all these kind and flattering words. But in a word, that flattery, it was just lies, right? We talked about already who Felix was. He was not good at his job. It was known throughout the land. Felix was not good at his job, especially to the Jews. He was known for putting down several insurrections with such hate and force, brutality, that he earned himself the horror of the Jews, not their thanks, right? In particular, he had ordered a massacre of thousands of Jews in Caesarea. He was known for doing that, and that the homes that were left had been raided by Roman soldiers. So all this flattery, all these kind words that Tertullus gives to Felix, I feel like even Felix himself might be thinking, there's no way he actually believes what he's saying. Really. But, so we talk about the charges against Paul, and these seem to be the charges. There are none, right? They accuse him of being a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, which is kind of the idea what the Roman commander had originally feared, like that he was a terrorist, that something was going on here. But they accuse him without any evidence. I call him a Nazarene because of the relation to the town of Nazareth that had a lowly reputation. It was essentially just a way to speak ill of those who followed Jesus, call them Nazarenes. It was seen as a lowly place. And we get this really interesting bit in, let me see if I can find the verse, in verse 5, where we found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. All the Jews throughout the world. That's almost an accidental compliment. You can imagine Paul lighting up a little bit, like, oh, they really believe I've gone throughout the world. My ministry has been that effective that I'm stirring up people. I'm bringing people to Christ. I'm bringing these Jews to Christ all throughout the world. That the gospel is reaching these people in every land. That's an accidental compliment. That is a good thing. He doesn't mean it as a good thing, but I'd imagine that Paul, at least I as a Christian, would take that as a compliment. Absolutely. Now, we talked about the only real accusation here is that Paul profaned the temple. He profaned the temple. Very vague. That's based on a rumor. In the second half of this accusation, where he actually gets to the vague accusations, it shows how furious the group is at the Roman commander for actually doing his job. They paint him in a bad light just because in three separate occasions he saved Paul's life. We already talked about this. And there's a little bit more insight that we'll have in Paul's response, because that's it. Just these few sentences. That's all Tertullus has to say about Paul. And then we get Paul's defense in verse 10, if you'll go there with me. It says, "Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, 'Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. And they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city, nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me.'" Again, Paul was probably quite relieved to hear the testimony against him, because it was very weak. There was no testimony against him. And you can note, he doesn't even try to flatter Felix when he begins to speak. Not only would he be lying in the first place, but he has no need of it. Their argument was so weak in the first place, he doesn't need to peg Felix's ego to prove his point. And the most important point he makes in his opening remarks is that 12 days had passed since this alleged crime occurred, and yet they bring the council, they bring the elders, they bring a lawyer to attempt to condemn him in front of Felix, but they don't bring any witnesses. They don't bring any people that were actually there. They don't bring anyone to testify against him or anyone to eyewitnesses to prove that the count is actually account is actually legitimate. So he says, "I do more cheerfully answer for myself." He thinks this might be easier than we thought. We continue in verse 14. "But this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which were written in the law and in the prophets. I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust." So we kind of get Paul going into really what he's most familiar with, the rhetoric that he's done over and over and over. We can remember any time he goes into the synagogue and he begins preaching and ministering to the people, he often starts with building a bridge between them, listing commonalities, He's saying, hey, I'm not really much different from my accusers. I'm not much different from these guys over here. He's saying, I haven't abandoned the law. He's saying, I haven't abandoned God. He's saying, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. All the Jews, save for the Sadducees, widely accept the resurrection of the dead. So he's saying there are commonalities between us, and he's kind of linking those to the governor. He continues, this being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. Now, after many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor with tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. See, he's bringing it up again. Right? Again, we kind of have to take the mantle up of the jury here and look at things from that sort of perspective. This is probably the strongest point in his defense, that the people who had raised this cry against him, there had been mobs of people here, people who had originally claimed to be eyewitnesses of this alleged sacrilege, everything they were accusing Paul of, they hadn't even troubled to be present for the trial. They're not even there to condemn him. And because Paul is in the right here, he's constantly calling the case back to the evidence, the same thing that his accusers are pretty intentionally avoiding. All right? Verse 20 says, or else let those who are here themselves say, if they had found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council, unless it is for the one statement which I cried out, standing among them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day. And this is really what Paul has to say for himself. Again, relatively short, a little bit longer than we got from Tertullus. And I like this next part because it's just funny to me. I don't know what translation y'all are reading out of. The NKJV, it titles the next passage, Felix Procrastinates, which I find interesting. And verse 22 says, when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way, he adjourned the proceedings and said, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case. So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him. So at this point, I think we all realize that Felix could have easily, very easily, ruled Paul as not guilty. He had enough evidence to do so, that being the lack of the evidence on one side. But my question is, why do you think that at this point he doesn't release Paul, order that he be released just here and now? What might cause him to make him remain, have him stay? More opportunities to solicit a bribe. That's a good one, and that's one that's pointed out in the next couple verses. This is the end of the verses that we're going to look at this week, but next week, that is what is listed as a primary reason. Felix, we've talked about this, he's not a good guy. He has no, he does not value the position that he has. He values his power. He values his authority. And anything that he thinks he can make a buck on, anything that he thinks can advance himself, he will take that opportunity. So part of the reason that he keeps Paul is he thinks he'll bribe him. He sees this man that was made a Roman citizen through his family lineage. Oftentimes they if they were not born as a Roman citizen, they had to, or family had been descended as Roman citizens, they had to pay a bribe. They had to pay a price to become Roman citizens. He thinks, maybe this man has money. Maybe I can extort him in some way. So that is absolutely one of the many ways he sees it. Any other reason why he might hold him back? I think he's not dim enough to realize that when the Jews accuse Paul of having spread dissension everywhere he's gone, they're not wrong. There has been turmoil everywhere he's gone, not because he's spreading lies, but because he's convicting people in the synagogues. And I think that's a fair assumption, that keeping Paul there might be safer for the governor than letting him go and continue doing what he's doing, even if it is just, even if it is true, even if it is right. Felix is not concerned with what's just and true and right. Anything else? Any other reasons he might be keeping him? Leverage in what way? Yeah, no, I think that's very reasonable. I think he's waiting for the commander as well. The commander gets thrown under the bus in the midst of all this, and he may want a little bit more information. How can I use this to my advantage, right? Exactly what you said. How can I use this as leverage? Because he's realizing somehow in the midst of all of this, the Romans got thrown under the bus. The Romans are at fault. The commander did something wrong, at least in the eyes of the Jews. How can I make this right? How can I get this entire population of people that is under me to respect me more, maybe fear me more? But yeah, I think leverage is a really fair assumption there. I think that's absolutely fair. Any other reason? I think the only other thing, and I don't want to give Felix much credit, but it does say, especially when you continue reading and you know how this all turns out, but you read here, let me find it, in verse 22, when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way, he had joined the proceedings and said, Lysias, the commander comes down, I'll make the decision on your case. So what was important, at least in some regard, is Paul explaining Christ, explaining the way. Obviously, Felix is pretty disconnected. He doesn't necessarily, we already talked about this a minute ago, understand the cultural proceedings of the synagogue. He very much was completely disconnected from the idea of Christianity. And I think to a degree, even though his primary motives are probably self-advancement, getting a bribe out of Paul, but I think to a degree he wants to hear more about the way. What is this thing that you're proclaiming that has stirred up so many people, right? And that's, other than that, I think we hit the nail on the head. I think there are a lot of reasons why he held them back, and everything we said here is absolutely valid. Is there anything anybody else would like to add before we wrap up, move back around into the challenges? Any insight that I could, you might be willing to offer for me? All right. So, I gave y'all a chance to sit on it for a minute. If you don't have anything, that's okay too. But, again, it helps us kind of moving forward. If we can reflect on the challenges that we've done over the past year, we can kind of know what works, give ourselves better challenges, something that will edify us more. So, if we had time to think and we want to talk about it, is there anything, any challenge that has really edified us over the last year? Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's the hope. And I mean, I don't present most of these challenges, probably 95% of them are things that I look at and I'm like, wow, here's an area that I'm really weak. Here's something I could really improve on, or that I'm not as strong as I'd like to be, or I haven't put as much thought as I want to put to. And that's why I offer it up. Because, it, like you said, it is all about finding our weaknesses and really rationalizing that. Why am I weak at that? Or finding your strengths. Yeah, and maybe it's an issue of, I hadn't done this before, I hadn't thought to try this before, and you dive into it, and it's like, wow, this is something I'm really interested in, or this is a methodology of worship that really resonates with me, or any number of things. Yeah, I think that's awesome. I think that's great. And with that, I'll move into our challenge for today. So, obviously, this evening we've been talking a lot about defense. Again, it's a court case, kind of isolated here in Acts 24, which is really cool. So we've talked a lot about defense. In the past, we've talked a lot about apologetics, right? The idea of defending the faith, apologetics. And this week, your challenge is to really independently research either an aspect of or an argument of apologetics that you find to be interesting or persuasive. And apologetics is all over the board. There are 1,000 different questions that you could be looking up. And again, this is all on you. You could be looking up... we talked about this a couple weeks ago, why would God send people to hell, right? Why would a good God send people to hell? Why is there evil in the world? That's what apologetics are. Those are the questions that we receive as Christians that, for a lot of people, have driven them away from the faith. And for us, when we're defending that faith, it's really important for us to answer them head on. So my really challenge for you is to study those hard questions that people ask. Just pick one out to kind of dive into. Listen to the arguments on, research, go to scripture on it, and then we can talk about that again next week. And if you want a reminder of what the challenge are, I have the cards right here. I'll put them on the table in the foyer, and you can go ahead and grab one on your way out. So I will say a prayer, and then we'll go ahead. We'll move into the next aspect of our service here. So I'll bow your heads with me. Dear Lord, thank you once again for the ability to gather here this evening. Thank you for just the wisdom in this room right now, just the people that are so eager and so devoted to your word, so willing to know more about you and just the history of the early church and the spreading of your gospel and taking that those ideas, applying them to our lives, using them in our own ministry, using them in the way that we go into our own neighborhoods and locales and spread your word. Thank you for the inspiration. Thank you for your word. Thank you for just, again, every opportunity that we have to come here and to worship you. Please be with us as we do so, as we worship you, as we hear a word, and as we move on with the rest of our service. And it's in your son's name we pray. Amen.
I won't say 654. Mark 842 is where it's on.
And then it's on the same as 654.
What a bringing heaven Jesus, all of our sins to bear. I'm
Good evening, church. So, I'm somewhat ill-prepared because I thought I was doing this next week, so I hobbled something together from a previous sermon I had done, like, evening service probably 5 years ago or so. But it kind of carries over, doesn't really carry over to what Reese was speaking about, but it's about the Apostle Paul and some of the many lessons that he taught throughout the New Testament. So I'm just going to briefly discuss a small fraction of a very important lesson, and that is the door to God's kingdom. And we all know that the Bible is the key to that kingdom and that salvation, and that's free. But what kind of door is it that we have to pass through? We have to pass through a narrow door. Luke 13, 24, 25 says, "Strive to enter through the narrow door. For many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. When once the master of the house has risen and shut the door, and you begin to stand outside and to knock at the door, saying, 'Lord, open to us,' then he will answer you, 'I do not know where you come from.'" In 1 Corinthians 16, 5-9, Paul says, "Now I will come to you when I pass through Macedonia, for I am passing through Macedonia, and it may be that I will remain, or even spend the winter with you, that you may send me on my journey wherever I go. For I do not wish to see you now on the way, but I hope to stay a while with you, if the Lord permits. But I will tarry in Ephesus until Pentecost. For a great and effective door has opened to me, and there are many adversaries." So it seems that Paul, he's very weary, and he's already spent over 8 years traveling from city to city on his first two missionary journeys. And he's been tirelessly preaching the gospel, starting churches, and facing constant opposition, including threats to his own life. During his third journey, he's in Ephesus, and he writes to his friends in the Corinthian church expressing a desire to visit them soon, possibly staying the winter if the Lord allows. But in the ninth verse, we'll notice that he says, "But I will stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost, because a great door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many who oppose me." Upon writing those words, Paul didn't know God was opening a great door for him in Ephesus, but Paul ends up staying 3 years there, more than twice as long as he ever stayed at any one place on his journeys. It would appear that God not only used Paul to start a great church in Ephesus, but while he was there, many more churches started in the community surrounding Ephesus, making it a center point from which the gospel flowed throughout all the provinces surrounding them. Now, Paul saw the opportunities that were there at Ephesus, and it was not exactly a place where Christians would want to settle or live. It was one of the larger cities in the Eastern Mediterranean, had a large financial and commercial district, and was financially prosperous. But it was also a city where people were superstitious and believed in magic, always looking for fortune tellers and the like to guide them in their lives. But when Paul looked at Ephesus and saw the hundreds of thousands of people going about their daily activities, he was determined to share the gospel with them. He saw an open door and decided to stay on a while longer. He saw the opportunity that was there. Paul also saw a door of obligation. And he said, "The door is open to me." He didn't say it was open to Timothy or Barnabas or anyone else. It had opened to him. He felt a personal obligation to stay in Ephesus and preach the word of God to them. And this is the same that's true for all of us. We, as Christians, have an obligation to share the gospel wherever we are. God's opening doors for us, but it's our obligation to walk through those doors. Matthew 7:7-8 says, "Ask and it shall be given. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened." So it works both ways. God is knocking, but if you cannot hear him, but you still need him, then you can start knocking and he will open the door for you. So just like God leaves the door of opportunity open for us, we must also leave the door of our hearts open to him and not let the world bog us down. So if you hear God knocking, it's best to open the door and let him in, or he might just leave you locked out. So tonight, if you have the desire or you need the prayers of the church, please come forward while together we stand and sing.
Thank you.